or is it you guys?
I need to go first.
Ben needs to go first. Okay. We're going to call the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means to order. We're going to open a hearing on Senate Bill 5509, which is the budget for the Department of Corrections.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Butler.
If I may divert back to the orders of courtesies, I'd like to recognize, I think he's here to testify today, former state representative from Baker City, Mike Nelson. Welcome, Mike. It's great to have you here.
Thank you very much.
I think you'll be testifying on behalf of corrections issues.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson, and welcome. We appreciate your service. I don't know if it's a good thing or bad thing. These were placements that come from those areas of the country, but we think he does okay.
Thank you.
You'll report to the people back home he does all right.
Thank you very much.
Doug, do you want to go ahead?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Sort of not related to this this department directly. In your packet is something I put together over the weekend, a quick comparison of the governor's revised and the chair's budget, just item by item for your reference. There are other charts that will come available, I'm sure, in the next week or so around that, too, but that's just for your reference. In your packets, there's a memo plus a series of handouts, and I want to go through these rather quickly, but just to sort of set the stage, it's sort of you got to have both of them in front of you. I apologize, but this is the easiest way to put it together. Usual things, budget notes and subcommittee expectations from last session. There's listed there. There's a number of budget notes, 11 of them in total that I have. Let me just make sure you understand on a few of them. They'll be coming back as part of their presentation and discussing some of those items, like number 3 on the first page there, dealing with the or DAs in Malheur, Marion, and Umatilla counties, and how the investigations and prosecutions of folks inside the institution. So this is a major issue for Representative Butler with Snake River in his district. Number 4, around Oregon Correctional Enterprises, this is to be a report as part of their presentation also. Number 9 and number 10 on the next page, just to give you, or number 9 for sure, and number 10 I just outlined to your a chair's interest around CJIS, Criminal Justice Information System, around that item, which there was a report to the Joint Committee on Information Management, as well as some discussions with a number of people in the legislature about this, but at this time it's been suspended, and I know the chair has interest in that. E-board actions, they're listed there, mainly rebalances. I will highlight number 3 to you, which is the Mill Creek property here in Salem across the freeway. You will have, or some subcommittee will have, a report coming back to you around the where they are in selling that property or developing, getting it ready for sale. I'm not sure exactly where that will be. It's correctional property, but I believe DAS is taking the lead in making that report.
When is the next report due today?
Sometime here in the next session. I talked to DAS last week, and they're putting together a report, an e-board-like report for the Ways and Means Committee. One audit, and it was a change of director audit. There were no major findings in there. Budget drivers are listed there. I think I'll skip those. And, of course, these are not all the budget drivers for this rather large agency. And move right on to major issues. I've listed a number of them, and let me quickly go through them. A lot of these will be emphasized in more detail, either by the department, in some cases DAS, or I just wanted to quickly highlight them so that in the back of your heads as you go through this agency's budget. DOC's 2003-05 governor's budget, and this is all before the revised budget. This is all talking of the original budget that was submitted at the beginning of the year. It's gross by $94 million, or almost 11% in terms of general fund. If you take a look at the attachments now that are in front of you, attachments 1 and 2, you'll see sort of why the reasons for the growth. Much of it was due to employee compensation issues are probably the primary driver, almost 83 or a little over $83 million general fund increases, but that also includes the second merits, which will be removed during work session. There are a number of backfills that happen. That's one reason for the large percentage growth. If you take a look at the second page of the handouts, attachment 2, this shows dramatically during the 0103 session, or during all the special sessions, one of the major savings was debt service for Department of Corrections. That top component of the bar on the general fund, attachment 2, is debt service. You'll notice that it fell significantly during the special sessions. The 0103 ledge approved and then grows back. That's all the construction savings, debt refinancing, and things that happened to provide savings to Department of Corrections. Don't expect that be able to fill holes in 0305 because there is no capital construction in the budget at this time, so there are really no savings, and refinancing, getting a pretty low interest rate now. So they were down to less than $30 million in debt service as it currently stands. In the current biennium, it grows back to $107 million general fund, and the growth is mainly due to all those one-time savings in 0103. That will also show, the first two attachments also show you sort of the breakdown in how the department's budget is broken. I think the DAS presentation will go show a pie chart, but you'll see that institutions makes up about half the budget, and that's all the security officers and the operations of the institution themselves. Point number two on on the memo refers to graphs 3 and 4, or attachments 3 and 4. Attachment 3 is a line graph, and it just sort of shows what's happened to cost per day per inmate over the last 10 or 15 years. This does not include capital construction or debt service or in some isolated admin costs, but it was really the cost of adding another inmate to the system in many ways. And you'll see that actually between 1999-01 and 2001-03, it went down a little bit, but it has also bumped back up to almost $70 per inmate across the entire system. Much of that is due to employee compensation issues again, and it will lower a little bit as we take out that second merit. There's a question.
Go ahead. Senator Devlin.
These numbers, though, are not adjusted for inflation. Right?
No, they are not. These are actual numbers.
So,
if you put inflation in that, you would probably see a pretty flat line, or yeah. I haven't actually done that. But the next chart is a pie chart that just sort of breaks those costs down to give you an idea of where the money goes, giving you some background. This is actually for the close of session 2103. The department is working on getting the same breakdown for the governor's budget, but it is quite a bit of work to come up with this. So this is just for graphic sake. Again, security represents 50% of this cost per day, and you can go around mental health, medical, and pharmacy. There's a lot of various costs that go into that. Item number three.
Mr. Chairman, this is the last time I'll take up. This is an interesting juxtaposition here on the cost per day category, and I assume the director will tell us if these are unrelated. I know they're unrelated. For example, food costs have fallen to less than $3 per day, while health care costs have increased. I assume there's no correlation.
Senator Devlin, I would hope not.
Okay.
Doug? And I'm sure the department will go into some detail about it. They really took an aggressive motion to cut their food costs, mainly because of central distribution and spot buying, and very effective in doing it. Attachment 5, and I will not go through this. This just shows you up, not including 5548, the sixth special session. This is where the savings were, and I think DAS, Linda, will go through some of the cuts throughout the special sessions. This puts it in one place. Just to note that many of those are one-time savings to balance the budget this current biennium. Actually, the first four items at the top represent one-time savings generally, either construction savings, delaying open of units, or refinancing a debt, or using federal resources. So that gives you an idea of how they balance their budget during 0103. the major driver in their budget, this is number four, is item number four on the memo is just the growth in the prison population. I believe on Wednesday you will hear from DAS. The forecaster will come in and provide you an updated prison population and community corrections forecast, and the department will be also include in theirs how they plan to get to that point, at least in prison construction, or not construction as much as use of emergency beds and the timing on that. But attachment six is a graph that just gives you an idea since 1989 what's happened with the prison population going from roughly 5,000 in 1989 all the way out, anticipating near 15,000 out in the year 2012. Right now it's right around 12,000. So you can see that the major drivers of that are ballot measure 11 and other changes like repeat property offenders. There's a big black sort of blob in the middle. That is the implementation of Senate Bill 1145. You passed that, and there was some major jail construction, and actually counties were renting space from Department of Corrections until those local jails were collected. So. But there was a downward trend overall because of Senate Bill 1145, as folks met, moved from state supervision or state incarceration to local incarceration for sentences of 12 months or under. Number five on my memo, and I mentioned this before, but the April forecast for the prison population and community corrections showed increases in the need for prison beds by about 250 by the end of the biennium, but there were community correction savings. The ability, number six on the memo, the ability for you to control as a legislature, control prison population is limited or will take very difficult decisions. And attachment number seven, which is a table or a sort of chart, shows you that. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but basically what I asked the department to do is sort of break down on where you have changes that are possible. So they look at timings. You have things like ballot measure 11, ballot measure 74, ballot measure 4. These are all in various time periods that are explained down on this sheet. But they basically limit what you can do. You either have to have super majority votes or constitutional changes or others to really make a large impact on the prison population. One thing that's in the co-chair's budget, if you go to the far right of the of that top or the second box, there are two things in the co-chair's budget that are assumed. The first time is increasing earned time credit from 20 to 25%, and second of all, the transitional leave to 90 days. Those are assumed in the governor's or the co-chair's budget.
That's a total of a little over $12
million. 12.6, I hope the math is right on that. And that's what is included in the co-chair's. Now, there's flexibility in there, but those will take changes. And in this case, it'll take us... it'll take, of course, a vote from the legislature to deal with that. Going on the list here, number seven, the governor's budget relies on the use of temporary beds. There is no new capital construction in this budget anticipated right now. I've included two charts, one for male, which is number 8, and one for females, which is number 9, that just sort of show you what the governor's budget anticipates. What I do want to point out here, and I'm sure they'll talk about this in their presentation, you have special purpose beds, and those are medical beds, special management unit, mental health beds that are special purpose beds in the system. Then you have the base capacity, which is all that gray area in the middle, or the lighter gray. You have added beds, which is sort of that darker gray area toward the top. And then the line represents total capacity. But keep in mind that you have people moving in and out of the special purpose beds on a regular basis.
And about 50 female and about a little over 1,000 male?
It looks that way. But the point I wanted to make is that line above the capacity is what they need, or what they say they need in flexibility to take into account folks moving in and out of that special purpose those special purpose bed units, as well as they've been running over capacity off and on during this biennium, over budgeted capacity, and that also takes into account making sure there's enough room. The females, just to notice, the long-term forecast creates some issues for them. They really did not anticipate the forecast of the female population growing in the out years as much as it does, and does raise, maybe not so much for this legislative session, but for next and the next after that. They're going to have to discuss what they do with the women's in the long range. They do not have planned capacity right now to take into that that growth.
November 03 increased base capacity
in women's or
in women.
That is bringing on, I believe, another unit at Coffee Creek.
Coffee Creek.
Yeah. Keep in mind that is the only place. Do you have any down at the boot camp? There's some females, but Coffee Creek is where the vast majority of the female population.
Small member.
Attachment 10 there is just a table that shows what's happened in the various sort of time periods in the last year, the pre-governor's budget, the governor's budget, and then the new March forecast response to the forecast on what they're sort of doing in terms of opening units or whatever. What they've done here, though, mainly is to move from new prison construction this biennium to the use of emergency beds and rental beds from county jails later on in the biennium, assuming that. So that is how they responded. They saved almost $50 million by using the emergency beds instead of building the new prisons that they had online before. Those included coming online sometime during 2003-2005, anticipation of Lakeview and Madras from their original plans from a year ago. That, of course, has changed. And, of course, Lakeview, there has been some discussion recently in the press as of this morning, and I'm sure the Lakeview folks have probably contacted people, and they will be in here on Monday. They would like to go forward. I think the governor's position is that they would like to explore going forward in that, too, without really having any cost during this biennium and opening it soon after the beginning of the 2005-2007 budget. But that would mean construction had to take place during this biennium. Number 8 on my list, or in the memo, community corrections is probably the largest hole in this budget. There's a hole of over $35 million. We're going to still, the department, Das and I, will get together and really zero in on what that hole is. But the what that provides some issues for you to think about is that the statutes allow counties to opt out once it drops below current service level, and the term current service level is used in statute in this case. At this time, Linn County has notified that they plan to opt out based on the levels in 2001-2003. My understanding is that Marion County has it on their agenda this week, and Lane County is thinking about, or is planning for it, someone said, on their agenda the week after this, or I guess next week. So there are counties that are seriously looking at that issue, and we're working with the department to really what that means budgetarily on what would happen if that was the case. Some of the other issues you need to keep in mind, counties pay roughly 25% of community corrections costs now. But that's really sort of, many counties don't pay at all. Multnomah County pays about 40% of their cost. So a lot of that 25% is in the largest county, basically, Multnomah. If that money came back to the, or if counties opted out, you would lose that resource potentially, because I don't think the counties are going to want to pay the state necessarily. What also comes back is not only the staff, and there's a lot of staffing issues in that, but jail capacity may also come back because the state has financed a lot of local jail construction as a result of Senate Bill 1145. There was a September e-board report, and I've asked the department to make sure they follow up with that in their presentation on community corrections about best practices and sort of taking a look at the effectiveness of community corrections across various counties. So they will be doing that. And just to note that reductions in other budgets, mainly in DHS or on alcohol and drug treatment programs, do affect the community correction system significantly, since such a large portion of those folks have substance abuse issues.
Will we have additional testimony as to what those effects are?
I'm sure we can probably find someone to do that.
Yeah, I think that would be important, particularly where we've got some discussion of additional community health, mental health monies in connection with the beer tax being discussed.
Number nine on the memo, the correctional programs. There is money in the governor's budget over and above what one estimates is constitutionally required. The problem is there isn't a fine, bright line what is constitutionally required until you get into a court case. So, but there, you know, there is some amount that is over and above what would be federally or state constitutionally required. Excuse me, and the co-chair's budget takes that into account to the tune of $7 million. And then finally, what I mentioned before, there is no further capital construction in this budget for 03-05. At this time, there's little additional debt service, and in fact, there's about $7.5 million of additional debt service growing in that, and they only need 1.5 of that. There is $6 million of excess debt service in the budget, and the co-chairs, as well as the governor's revised budget, reflects that. So with that, before I lose my voice, Mr. Chair, I will quit and turn it over to the department.
Thank you.
An overview.
Are there questions of Doug with his waiting voice? Ben, why don't we just go ahead and...
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Benjamin DeHaan. I'm the interim director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. And given the fact that Doug's testimony and summary was so complete, I think I'll be able to burn through my overview fairly quickly, particularly since there's such a we have a knowledgeable committee here, and one of which a member actually worked at one of our prisons. There's a high degree of information already present here. What I intend to do is to run through the first pages of our document. I'll go through pages 1 through 19, and then I can see from your agenda that we have invited testimony, and I think also later on in the week you'll be getting more detailed information from DOC staff. I have in the room with me here Sue Acuff, who is the Assistant Director for Business and Finance. She's here, as always, to ask to answer any of your more detailed budget questions and to track down any other information that you might need. So we'll start on page one. The agency mission, I think, is fairly clear, although we have a two-part mission. That is, obviously, we hold offenders accountable, but we also are responsible for reducing the risk of future criminal conduct. If you look at departments of corrections from around the nation, I think you would find that your department has a slightly broader mission. I think most departments are more completely focused in on controlling the activities behind the walls, and I believe personally that many of them don't give enough attention to actually what happens in leveraging the investment in an institution and following the offender back home. I think one of the things that most people don't understand about our system is that 94% of the inmates ultimately return home, and that really does guide the decisions that we make within the institutions and the selection of programs and so forth. We believe that if you have the right conditions existing in an institution, that you can materially affect the chances of success post-release. And the things that we believe are important is a very high degree of structure, a very respectful environment, and we also have been focusing a lot on criminogenic assessment, which is kind of a highfalutin way of looking at the risk factors that cause criminal conduct. I think it's important to say as well that two-thirds of the inmates in the state of Oregon don't come back to us. Now, I would caution you not to make any judgments about that in comparisons to other states, because really everybody measures it differently. What we do know from looking at the research is that our recidivism rates compare favorably, but you have to understand that the range is somewhere from 7% last time I looked in Kansas to 90% in some of the larger jurisdictions, depending on how you define the issue. If you go to the second page, you'll see a chart It's a very simple statement that basically shows you that we have almost three times as many offenders in the community. It's a very simple but a very important message that, that people need to hear. The prison environment is a critical piece of this, but we shouldn't forget that so much of the work goes on in the communities. Page 3, turn to page 4, and what you'll see is a reflection of some of the trends that were described earlier by Mr. Wilson. What this chart shows you is obviously that there's an increasing, a dramatically increasing number of inmates, and you heard the effect that that has on our budget. You should also know that the forecast that was just released in April on average jumped up about 200, and that means that we're going to go to about 13,000 by the end of next biennium. The governor's budget, as you heard, does not reflect this increase, and in fact our plan is to manage that by absorbing almost 1,000 inmates into the existing facilities and also by renting beds from the locals. It also is clear that the governor's revised budget, and the governor's balanced budget for that matter, does not assume any changes in policy. So everything that you see here is assuming that the policy remains as is. If you look at page 4A, that's another representation of what Doug was talking about earlier. On Wednesday, you'll hear directly from Sue Porter, who does the forecasting for DAS at the Office of Economic Analysis. And what it shows you is the percentage of the growth that's attributable to Measure 11. And I think that's been discussed enough here and elsewhere. People understand very clearly what the issues are there. Page 5, the challenges. Obviously, the primary challenge that faces us is absorbing more inmates into the institutions and to make sure that they're run safely and securely and that we get the desired effect. Again, it goes back to our second part of our mission statement. When you think about the 24,000 plus that we spend on incarceration, and you think about how expensive a failure is to the taxpayers, you should demand a very high degree of effectiveness in our programs and a very high level of sophistication in choosing those programs and sequencing them. I think to summarize that piece, it's very clear that just running the institutions is a necessary condition, but it's not sufficient to get the result that the taxpayers and you expect. If you turn to page 6, basically you can see that the other fund portion, as Doug said, is shrinking. That's construction related.
Let me just stop you right there for just a moment, Ben, and let me ask this question just quickly. I'm sure that there's an answer, and it's got to be something other than money, but Oregon's, as we're talking about recidivism, I hope it's not just a resource issue, but as we're talking about recidivism, 66% don't return in Oregon. In a state where they've got 90% that don't return, only 10% recidivism, what's the major single factor besides money that causes the difference between 66% and 90%?
Mr. Chair, I raised that issue really to highlight for the committee that there are huge differences in the way people count and define recidivism.
I see.
The variation really isn't that big.
Okay.
And I would say you can rest assured that Oregon is in the top 30% in the nation.
And of actual completion?
As far as getting the effect.
Okay.
I've spent a lot of time over the last 8 years looking at this, and the variation really makes it difficult to make comparisons. So when we get to the performance measure piece, what we do is show you the things that we think are related to success and show you how we track those.
Chair recognizes Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your percentage for recidivism, are you including in that factor people that are coming back to the institution for a second time, in the sense that, I mean, if you took the people that were repeat offenders out of the calculation and simply said those people that are doing state time for the first time, what percentage can come back? Would that be similar to a state that might get a higher percentage?
Probably.
Rather than simply, but are you, in your case, you're counting both the people that are coming for their first time and coming back again. And then two-thirds of those people don't come back again. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Senator Devlin, we define someone recidivating as committing a new felony within 3 years post-release, and that would bring them back.
But some places, I would think that maybe not Oregon, but some places, you know, a significantly smaller percentage of the population would be people that had never served any time before in a state facility, but it would be, well, places that didn't have the same, I'm trying to figure out a simple way to say this, because if back in the days when, they're doing a little bit more time now, but back in the days when people that committed the crime of burglary came in, did 9 months, went back out, came back, did another 9 months, went back out, and it was like basically just a method of operation. Your recidivism level was probably higher.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, that is actually correct, because with the advent of 1145, we now see a fairly highly recidivating population being served in the communities. Property offenders, for example, drug offenders serving less than a year, that was a recidivating bunch. And so the recidivism numbers for this state have been relatively flat, but there was a small drop associated with 1145 just because we took that recidivating population out. And there are variations in policy like that across, and definitions across our nation. And so what we try to do is to look more closely at actually what they do. It's important to track recidivism, but there are other measures that are important as well.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. If you'll turn to page 7, we have a breakout of where we actually spend our money, and basically what it does is it shows you a picture of what Doug was telling you. Three-quarters of the budget's in institutions, counties, and debt. Another 14% really is in programs, and within those programs, there are some small minority that are what some would consider optional. Mostly they're driven, some $90 million out of the $135 million in the program budget is driven by constitutional or some legal mandate. What Doug didn't mention, and it's one of the reasons that the line between mandated and non-mandated gets blurred, is that Measure 17 is a constitutional requirement, and a lot of our educational training actually moves us towards compliance with a constitutional mandate, and we often don't consider that in our discussions. All of this just shows you that there's actually very little flexibility that exists. There's about 10% remaining that for HR, ISSD, all of our related business functions. If you would turn then to page 8, if there are no questions on that, I'll keep going. One of the, as I mentioned earlier, if you believe that one of the things that we have to get done is not only incapacitate inmates but also make them less dangerous when they get back to the community, then you have to ask us, well, what did we do to try and get to that goal? In 01-03, we spent a tremendous amount of time thinking about the Oregon Accountability Model, which is our general rubric for what it is that we're trying to get done within the institutions. You're going to get a lot of detail tomorrow from Scott Taylor when we talk about all the pieces that are in the Oregon Accountability Model. It's our way of organizing these programs and moving towards effectiveness. 01-03, we spent a lot of time on that. We spent a tremendous amount of time on considering evidence-based programs. Some of you may have heard Ed Latessa when he was out here. Other experts have come to talk about what Oregon's doing in that regard. I think we've made a lot of progress. The other thing that we spent a lot of time doing in 01-03 is managing this growth. I mean, you saw from the chart what's happened at the Department of Corrections, and managing growth is a huge issue for those who run your own businesses. You understand how that works. Probably one of the most challenging events for any kind of organization is to have something continuously growing. Some of our partners have used the analogy, it's like trying to remodel an airplane while it's in flight. We don't have the latitude to stop and retool our programs and some of our products, if you will. In the 03-05, we're going to continue this kind of work. I mean, obviously the growth is continuing, but we have some other things that we need to worry about as well. We've got to manage an increasing population without construction. Though I know that Senator Devlin would appreciate what that does to an atmosphere in an institution when you keep putting more bodies in. It's going to be a major challenge, but we think we can do it.
And why would Senator Devlin appreciate that?
Mr. Chair, I should
I'm
be
kidding.
Clear about that. Senator Devlin worked there. He wasn't residing there, as far as I know.
Just for the record.
And one of the other challenges that we'll be facing is a leadership transition and a tremendous number of employees who are eligible to retire. So recruitment and maintaining our leadership and our qualified staff throughout our institutions will be a major issue for the next budget. Now, I'll turn your attention to page 9. Actually, it starts at the very bottom of page 8. Those are our agency performance measures. The first 5 or so are related to the recidivism issue that we discussed earlier. And so if you just very quickly look at those, you can see that these are all related to inmate performance or systems performance related to what happens with inmates. I won't read all of those to you. The department got involved in this in about 1995. We have a very large number of performance measures. We've only reported some of these. If you have any interest in looking into them with any more detail, you can go to our website. I think they're all laid out there. And you feel free to do that. Page 10, Oregon Accountability Model. Again, you're going to be hearing more about that tomorrow. But very briefly, it's the way that we organize our approach to inmates. It involves 6 components, and you can see them laid out here. There's really nothing terribly new about this, with the exception of we took what was working in other states and transported pieces of it here. We worked very closely with the Canadians, who are very well developed when it comes to intake and assessment processes, criminogenic factors. So we sort of borrowed and stole the best of what we could find around the country and married it with what is and what always has been a very strong correctional system. So if anything, it would represent marginal improvement to a very strong system that pre-existed. I'm going to skip over the next couple of pages and take you to page 13. Agency organization, we basically have 5 program units for the purposes of the budget presentation. You'll be hearing directly from the people who are responsible for those 5 areas. And you can see there are correctional programs, institutions, administration, central support, and lastly, grants to counties and for community correction services. The institutions, we have a dozen of them. If you look at page 18, it'll show you exactly where they're located. On this page, page 13, it just lists them. And if you want to know any more specific information about any individual institution, Mitch Morrow will be here. He's the assistant director for institutions. He'll be here to talk you through the individual programs and the individual institutions.
Just so the committee knows, I've asked the department for a staffing matrix on each of the institutions, a summary breakdown, so we can take a look at that.
On page 14, I summarized very quickly the major program changes and reorganizations dating back to 1995. That's when I arrived at the Department of Corrections with Dave Cook. I came down from Portland State University. Dave came up from Benton County, and we worked there together until he retired last July. A lot of the changes that we made during that time were all related to the things that I discussed, the need to create systems in an environment that was changing rapidly and growing very quickly. We had Measure 17, which was just passed by the voters, Measure 11, just passed by the voters, and the previous director had resigned, and all but one, I think, of the executive staff had resigned as well. I came down for a 3-month job, a consulting job, and didn't ever go back, and I'm still here.
Trying to escape, though.
Yeah, I think I'm asking the governor to commute my sentence. So we'll see. We'll see how that works. At any rate, if you require any kind of detailed information about any of those, I can give it to you. Otherwise, you can just look at them there. Cost control activities on the bottom of page 14. I think that you heard some of them this morning. Our biggest, one of our largest successes has been in creating the central distribution center and driving the cost of meals down to, I think it's $2.30 in that area. $2.30 to feed an adult three meals a day, I think, is impressive. And we do it through an efficient distribution network and spot buys. And the way the spot buys work, if someone has cost production overruns in a French fry plant, then we buy a trainload of them and everybody eats French fries. And it's a gross oversimplification, but the bottom line shows a tremendous amount of success. We've done similar things in energy usage, and we've spent a lot of time thinking about the cost of pharmaceuticals, mostly because pharmaceuticals and other medical-related practices were eating up our program budgets. And so failure to get a handle on that would not only cost taxpayers more than necessary, it would also strip all the programs ultimately out of the institutions. Information technology, page 15. Basically, DOC operates a wide area network, and it's got lots of things going on. We've got business functions that we provide, inmate location, assignments, transfers, canteens, visitation, those kinds of things. And we're also now developing, you may have heard about the TAP project, Transition Automation Project. It's a major systems improvement. That goes beyond case management activities. It goes beyond the business functions and really will set the foundation for assessing change in individual inmate performance. And that's something that the last legislative session funded. And the program is about 85% complete now. The other issues, obviously we share information with the community correction staff. They use a tactical information system. They run their caseloads with it. And we have representatives from the communities who could give you more information about that. We also have we call it an AFAMIS system. It's an acronym for a business management system. It is now failing to be supported by the providers, and we're having to replace that. John Teresky will be here. He's our chief information officer. He'll be here this week, and he can give you some detailed information about those individual efforts if you like. Okay, I'm going to turn to page 17 now. Very quickly, I'll mention Oregon Corrections Enterprises. It's actually a separate organization. It's a quasi-independent state agency. Technically, it's not part of the Department of Corrections. It was created by a vote of the people and constitutional change in 1999. The administrator of OCE reports to me. But beyond that, we have obviously a very constructive relationship, but the legislature doesn't review the individual line items. We actually send a report every couple of years, I think, or maybe it's yearly, to DAS, and that's a system of accountability. I supervise that person the way I would any other DOC employee, however, and that's the way the model is set up. Affirmative action, very quickly, you can see that the women are underrepresented. They comprise only 30% of the department's employees. They're 50% of the world's population. I think that's pretty obvious. We're doing okay as far as retaining and recruiting employees of color. The issue there, though, is that they are generally at the lower positions in our organization, and we need to do a lot more work there. We just haven't made the progress that we should have. And people with disabilities are significantly underrepresented because of the conditions, mostly the conditions that we work under, and the physical requirements for certification. Then lastly, I'll refer you, two more pages left. 18 is the map that we already looked at. And then lastly, on page 19 is an overview. It's our org chart. And I think that it just reflects all the things that I said and that Doug has said. So with that, I'll end my formal presentation and respond to any questions you might have.
Questions? Senator Devlin.
With the some of the cuts that you've taken, has it been a challenge to actually meet the requirements of Measure 17? In the sense that, I mean, you have this separate entity out there now that's running programs, in a sense. But some of those, my understanding is some of those aspects of that separate entity are not doing too well, particularly given, like, the governor's freeze on purchases of furniture and that your shop that produces furniture, I don't even know if it's still open. And in the sense of, well, Measure 17 had, in a sense, lofty goals, but does it just basically create a way to have to make work for inmates?
Chair, Senator Devlin.
Which requires greater supervision.
Yes. You'll get varying opinions on that, I'm sure. I'm a big fan of Measure 17. And the reason for that, I'm not sure exactly what was in the voters' minds when they passed it. If you read the constitutional amendment, it's pretty moralistic, and I think a lot of voters had in mind people in striped suits swinging hammers, breaking rocks. What happened though is it got the creative juices flowing of the Department of Corrections and forced us to take a close look at some of the internal operations. Our high point, I think, as far as compliance goes, was about 86%. We're hovering around about 80% now. The Constitution requires 100%. We're not going to get there without an infusion of money because there are only so many people filling up jelly jars in the mess halls that you can do, and we've maxed that out. We're not a model of efficiency when it comes to vacuuming and mowing lawns and doing those kinds of things. We try and put as many people to work as we possibly can. The program offices, the programs contribute in a very large way because the Constitution allows us to prepare people to work in addition to actually working. Half of their full-time work can be done learning as long as it's related to work. So I guess that's a long-winded way of saying I think it's had a very beneficial effect. I think as the system grows, 60% of the jobs that are actually being filled by inmates now are in institutional support, and we're going to run out of those.
Mr. Chairman, follow-up.
Senator Devlin.
What is the long-term plan in terms of on the more traditional prison industry side?
The reason that we separated, the people of Oregon separated OCE, I testified on the record at the time that the referral was passed out by the body. And really the issue was that we were going to strangle our private partners and we were going to strangle our businesses through a lot of red tape. And so we argued that if you could make us a little more efficient, that we would not take any taxpayers' money and we'd run it like a business. That is the case today. There's no general fund invested in OCE. We cut the workforce in half. Some of these cuts were very, very difficult. And we closed a lot of businesses that weren't productive. The bottom line today is that you have OCE is self-sustaining. It's fairly strong financially. And our vision for that is that they will reinvest. They aren't allowed to have a profit. But if there is any money, it has to go directly back into supporting inmates to make them more supporting them in training them and so forth. So, I mean, we're not living in the lap of luxury, but we aren't bleeding red ink everywhere. We're self-supporting, and that's a huge step forward for that operation.
Representative Fowler. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ben, we visited last session about one issue that I know that we didn't modify in any way, shape, or form that I can recall, and that is the definition of 40-hour work education process with people, with inmates coming and going to class and what constitutes I mean, if we just had the normal work week as opposed to a 40-hour work week in definition, is that something that's going to require is that a constitutional change? Is my recollection, or is that something we can, or does the department have some
legislation proposed to get us back in line with the something greater than the 80% target there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, my memory could be faulty on this, but as I recall, we did modify the Constitution that allows us to include necessary security practices and transport back and forth to work, which I believe gave us an extra
5 hours.
Yeah, 5 hours. Okay. So I think we've already solved that problem.
So the 80% is being hit as a result of that, because I know that we were woefully deficient from the 40-hour work week originally.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that's correct.
Thank you very much.
All right. With that, no further questions? Mr. Net, so Ben, you're done. Anything? Mr. Nelson, welcome.
Thank you.
We appreciate you being here today, especially from Baker.
Baker City.
Proceed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mike Nelson. I'm a local businessman in Baker City, Oregon. And appreciate being here, Mr. Chair, fellow representatives, fellow senators. And I applaud my illustrious representative, Mr. Butler, wearing his beef hat today. And we appreciate that. And if you want to know where's the beef, we can tell him where the beef is, can't we?
Absolutely. 500,000 head can't be all wrong, can
it? That's right. Well, I'm surprised the rest of the representatives didn't have them on, Tom, but we can get you some more hats. Okay.
Great.
So,
thank you.
It's really nice to be here. And I, Mr. Chair, I have a lot of friends I worked with in the past back here and said hello to some of them. It's nice to be able to come here and testify on behalf of a story that is in government is a success story, and that's I want to talk about the Powder River Corrections Facility. Is a story of success, and the genesis of that was in the mid-80s when we start revolutionizing our corrections program in this state, which had not had much sunlight on it for a lot of years, when other communities were squealing and hollering and resisting a facility being built in their community. Baker City rose to the occasion and formed a committee and raised a considerable amount of money and bought some land and donated it to the state of Oregon to build Powder River Correction Facility. Powder River has not only been a success for the state of Oregon, but it's been a success for the community. We have a Citizens Advisory Committee, and it'll be happening, I believe, next month. Every year since the groundbreaking and the opening of Powder River, we have a Citizens Participation Day at the facility where our local citizens bake a bunch of cakes and cookies, and we go out and visit the inmates, and we have the whole day where we serve them and interact with them and let them know how much we're supportive in them becoming taxpayers instead of tax users. And it's been a very emotional program at times. And I would welcome any of you to come out and participate sometime. It's a unique reversal of roles. It's very unique. And we have, so we call it our annual Inmate Appreciation Day. Well, you know, all those things are really nice and warm and fuzzy, but what makes sense out of Powder River? Well, it really is one of the crown jewels in the Oregon correction system. In fact, we have people from all over the nation come in and study the alcohol and drug treatment side of the of Powder River Corrections, and we all know we in our minds, and we'd like to on perpetrators on criminals, we'd like to lock them up and throw the key away, but that's not what really happens. And so with Powder River, we take people who are qualified, inmates who are qualified, and have identified the root problem, and that's drug and alcohol. They have to qualify for the program, and they go through an intensive treatment process. And guess what? It works. We have a very minimal. And I listened to Mr. Dehan speak. We have a very minimal recidivism after 3 years. I think, I forget who asked about recidivism. It's how, the, if you know, if you're 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, but it's about 85% people are successful after 3 years, and that's an incredible statistic nationally. And so what does that do? That equates to savings to the taxpayers, and that's why I'm sitting here testifying. The program works. The program is not only works in the community, but it works for the state of Oregon, and we take people who are going to be cost the taxpayers money for a long period of time, and we put them in a program that works. I've met many of these inmates, and I've visited with them many times. I've brought many other, and I would love to have you come out, Mr. Chair, and go through the facility. I've had many representatives and senators and some of our congressional delegation go through the drug and alcohol treatment side of the program, and it's impressed them. And so I've met many of the inmates and watched them progress over the years and leave the facility and go on to be productive members of society and actually produce income tax. And I just can't emphasize enough that, as you know, we can't spend our way out of the problem. And this is one of the programs in the entire correction package that really works, and I'm here to ask you for your support for this program and would like to see it enhanced because when it comes to bottom line, and that's Representative Butler's other profession as a CPA, he knows what bottom line means. I run my own business and have several other businesses, and bottom line is where it all comes out in the wash. Bottom line, representatives and senators, the Powder River Correctional Facility works, and so I thank you for this opportunity to drive over from Baker City, and I'm going to drive back here as soon as I'm done. So, again, thank you very much.
Representative Butler. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Mike coming over. Mike, the model that we have at the Powder River Facility has got to be unique. It certainly is unique in the Oregon system. And it's got to be, I've got to believe that it's unique nationwide because of the acclaim that it gets. But it relies a huge amount on early on citizen involvement, citizen commitment to it, and citizen participation. Do you know if in that process, and I'm talking about all the way from the A&D intervention and family intervention at the facility all the way through the local contract providers and their participation at the facility. Do you know if that comes at an extraordinary cost to the state? What's the cost factor? And I appreciate the fact that it may have more cost, but if it comes out in terms of recidivism at the other end, do you have a feel for that? And if not, we can certainly get it from Sue. Or
yeah, and. When it comes to the $2.30 a day stuff, Tom, I'm not really good at that. But my understanding, it's a net. There's about a 1.3 savings to taxpayers in the program. And Representative Bundle, you're absolutely right. It's that early intervention. And I want to make full disclosure. I don't have any relatives that work there. I have no connection, no parochial interest. I'm not a provider. I've been involved in this system, and when I was a state representative and helped with the adolescent drug and alcohol, the YCERT program, because it was just really evident that if you can get that early intervention that's tied to drug and alcohol, we can get these people out of there and have a safer society. And just to highlight, when I've been out there many times going through facility, I mean, our perception of a criminal is, you know, wearing a dark hat and a raincoat, and you think you can pick them walking up and down the street. There's some really bright people in that facility that have substance abuse problems. So when it comes to the exact numbers, I think I'll allude to the paid analyzers.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
But it's also my understanding, Mike, that early on also to participate in that program in a minimum security arrangement throughout the system, what goes on at Powder River is known throughout the entire correction facilities, throughout the entire state.
The nation.
Right, throughout the nation, but certainly anybody that's been put into the Oregon system of corrections knows and understands that if they could get into Powder River, they'll find solutions to the heavy questions they've been asking as to why they're there and where they're going, where they came from. But my concern is, do we know if we've got to have the best of the best. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just say this. Having gone through that and having gone in and shaken hands with these folks, rubbed shoulders with them for a few hours, not just the volunteers and the other folks from the community that participate there on a daily basis, but with the prisoners themselves and pick out any five of them that you want from the population and go and interview them privately and say, why are you here and where are you going? And I mean, I came away with tears in my eyes over the fact these guys really knew why they were there and what they were going to do. And they were making some lifetime changes, and that their sincere desires were to come out and become productive citizens. But are we, you know, Mike, if we've got more of a population that want to get in than we actually have slots available in that system?
Well, that was the issue with the YSERV program, that we didn't have enough slots. Yeah, we could. That's what we're here for. That's exactly what I'm promoting, is that it would be nice to have some more slots on the other side. You know, it houses two different units. And if you ask me another question, I really want the chair to, I don't know of any other correctional facility in the state, Representative Patridge, that we have a local group of just lay citizens called the Powder River Advisory Committee that meets every month and interacts with the administration, and I mean, it is, that's what I said, that's all warm and fuzzy, but it's still got to make sense. So when it comes to his latter question,
Ben, can you speak as to the backlog
for the record, I'm Benjamin Dehan, Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. This is an issue probably that will be discussed in a lot of detail tomorrow when we're talking about programs. But I guess the real important aspect of Powder River that should be considered statewide is that the level of community involvement that we see has a huge benefit to taxpayers, because it does supercharge our programming. The message that the community sends these folks when they come in is it's not only a welcoming message, it's an accountability message. And that place does get results. Here's how it saves us money. Potentially, what we'd like to do in the next biennium is to do a random assignment to both Shutter Creek down on the coast and also to Powder River, pulling from the same group of inmates and basically testing out the result. Shutter Creek gets a big return on investment because of the time cut. There is a bill floating around now that would allow us to apply the time cut to Powder River, because we think that has a huge amount to do with offender success, in addition to all the other things that we talked about. So the real exciting thing here is that through all the good work in Baker City, we have a model that we think can be replicated in lots of other places, time cut or no time cut, and we think that it'll be very cost effective. The bar for success is relatively low because the cost of incarceration is so high. So it's pretty easy to make a pencil out. Anyway, we do.
And just so the committee knows, I've asked DOC to take a look at programs like Powder River or other more intensive management types of programs to intensify the ability to do good time. And we'll also spend some time when we walk through the
the institutional piece and the programming piece as to the efficacy of the boot camp programs and how they relate in terms of the boot camp model, because I think the national literature raises some questions as to the effectiveness of those programs versus programs like Powder River that have the huge community buy-in.
Mr. Chair, I do have a concern, however, of trying this program. I appreciate Director DeHaan saying that it's something that we'd like to try in other places. I think that's wonderful, man. I don't misunderstand. But I don't... When I took over the service of Baker County and Baker City, I mean, the difference of Baker County with the balance of my district, what it used to be and what it is today without Baker County, it's just the difference between night and day. People are very community-centered, very, very community-oriented people, whereas in the other small communities we've got, they're not quite that oriented. And yeah, they'll take care of their neighbor if their neighbor happens to have the ox and the mire. But it seems to be a whole different mindset, the whole culture in Baker County. And if you look at what people have done to return back to the community, not just in terms of returning warm bodies back to the community and returning there to live and raise their families, but also willing estates, fairly substantial estates and so forth, back into the community. That's not something that we see in many other counties. Yeah, we might have someone leave something for the historical society, or we might have, but ball fields and other kinds of things. So this is a very unique community, and if we could do it, we'd want to try and clone Baker County and Baker City, particularly where they have that investment. You know, I'd love to see that kind of community involvement statewide. So you may not enjoy, particularly if you've got facilities already in existence, and you don't have that early buy-in, because in that process, the people really went out to make a difference with the first inmate, and have made that difference. And these folks, as I say, Mr. Chair, they early on identified, they could point out and they'd say that person over there hasn't bought into the fact that that the policemen are his friends, and I have, and I've got a mind change and a difference. And what's your goal when you get out? Well, the first thing I'm going to do is try and get my family to realize that I was wrong and had been wrong all of that time, and they're not telling that to me because I'm sitting on a parole board. But it's Mr. Chair, it's a member, it's the makeup of the community and the mindset of the community, that it's a community effort to make those folks, when you go in and have a party for the people on the inside, to let them know that it's good to be on the outside, it's wholesome to be on the outside, and, you know, the guards and the policemen are your friends, the law, the peace officers. It's something that we're going to have to try and replicate that community spirit statewide, and that's a tall order. That's a tall order.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for coming over. We certainly appreciate it, Mr. Nelson. We know it takes a lot of time and effort out of you. Joanne Fuller. Thanks for joining us again today, Joanne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Joanne Fuller, and I'm the director of the Department of Community Justice in Multnomah County. And the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors has asked me to speak on their behalf to talk to you a little bit about community corrections. I've given you some written testimony. I'm not going to read it. I just want to share with you some highlights. I think that the legislative fiscal staff has done an excellent job of giving you the short synopsis of the issues that face community corrections here in the budget. One of the things that I wanted to talk to you about today is not just the money, but the vital role that community corrections plays and the great value that you're getting in purchasing community corrections in the 36 counties in Oregon. Community corrections has a unique role that we play in the criminal justice system. Not only do we hold people accountable, but we're also uniquely responsible for long-term behavior change. You were just talking about the wonderful program out at Powder River, and I think that one of the reminders is that No matter what prison program someone goes through, most offenders come back out into the community to be under supervision in community corrections. And hopefully what we're doing with them in community corrections is either sustaining that behavior change that happened for them in the prison if they went through the great program at Powder River or some of the other wonderful programs in prison, or helping to start that behavior change so that they don't reoffend and wind up back in the system again. We have under our supervision about 30,000 felony offenders, both parolees and probationers in the state of Oregon. And the bulk of those offenders actually are probationers who haven't been to prison and are never going to return, hopefully. And if we do our job well, less of them will return, will ever go to prison than before. With community corrections in the state, one of the things that we've been doing is trying to address the best practices literature. Many of you heard Dr. Ed Latessa speak before the legislature talking about what the literature in our profession tells us about what works with offenders and what makes behavior change happen. And what we've been doing in Oregon really is applying that literature in every county in the form of our community corrections. We are focusing on a range of graduated sanctions and treatment interventions as well as supervision. And you know that Dr. Latessa says that supervision alone won't change offender behavior. We are focusing resources on higher risk offenders, and the literature clearly shows that focusing on high risk offenders is the best way to impact long-term recidivism. We are targeting treatment interventions to crime-related risk factors. Those are things like lack of education, lack of job skills, lack of housing and basic stability, and in particular, drug and alcohol problems. As most of you know, about 70 to 75% of offenders in the criminal justice system have some kind of drug and alcohol problem. And if we're not able to address that, oftentimes we're not able to make a difference in terms of the long-term behavior change. The partnership between the state and the counties in Oregon that is represented by Senate Bill 1145 has really allowed local counties to develop flexible community correction systems. What that means is that we're able to meet local needs. We're also, as your fiscal staff reminded you, able to use community resources in an effective way to leverage those state dollars to be able to buy more for community corrections funding. As you pointed out, in Multnomah County, we fund a significant amount of especially drug and alcohol treatment for offenders with local dollars that wouldn't necessarily be available if this partnership didn't exist. One of the things that you talked about earlier was the success rate and the recidivism rate and how it compares nationally. In the latest report on the forecast, they quote a 55.5% national recidivism rate. And in Oregon, we have an average of about a 42% recidivism rate. Now, as Ben DeHaan pointed out, those recidivism rates are difficult to compare. However, I think it's an indicator that we're doing something well in Oregon, both in terms of the prison system and also in community corrections. One of the challenges before you is what to do about community corrections funding. Right now, as it sits, the community corrections budget has been cut approximately $40.1 million, depending on where you start or finish your computations. For community corrections...
That's the note we're writing back.
Yes. I won't quibble about the numbers. Fundamentally, the issue for us in community corrections is that we need to have that cut restored. If we're expected to supervise the number of offenders that are projected to come to us, we need to have the full funding in order to be able to do that and in order to be able to get the kind of successes that I've been talking about earlier and implement the kinds of programs we've implemented. If restoration is not possible, then we have to look at reducing the number of offenders that are supervised in the community. Mr. Chair, you've been involved in a set of discussions with a whole range of criminal justice partners that have included sheriffs, county representatives, representatives of the DOC, representatives of the Criminal Justice Commission, the Indigent Defense, to talk about how it is that we could create that caseload reduction. And the proposal that's on the table really calls for reducing that caseload based on the sentencing guidelines. That is an option that no one wants to endorse. That is an option that means that offenders would be in our community without supervision. They're still there in our community doing whatever they're going to do, only now they don't have any supervision to try to keep them from doing it, slowing them down, or getting them to change their behavior. However, if we don't get the funding that we need in order to do the services that we've been doing in the counties and continue the partnership with the state, we're really forced to consider that option as something as the only way that still allows us to have truth in sentencing and isn't just a cost shift to the community when we look at cutting state money. The crimes that we're talking about here are crimes that are kind of heart-stopping when we think about it, as folks that would get some kind of sole sanction and not get ongoing supervision and intervention in the community. Once we move past possession of a controlled substance, which is the kind of first level that we would look at, we then get into theft one, ID theft, burglary, UUMV, and attempt to elude a police officer. It scares me to think that the people that had committed those crimes would be running around our community without supervision. But if we can't get the restoration, counties are going to be forced to make a very draconian choice. Do we opt out when we know that with community corrections legislation, we have been very effective at managing offenders in our community and making a difference? And we don't believe that the state can do this any better than we have been able to. However, we cannot continue to manage the number of offenders that would be given to us with the money that we're talking about. So today, I know that you have incredibly difficult choices, and I know that there are an awful lot of programs that are coming to you saying that they need their funding restored, and the budget is a tremendously difficult thing to get balanced. But I would encourage you to think seriously about the funding for community corrections and recognize that we're in a partnership with the state and we're trying to create public safety not only across the state but in every individual community. Thank you for having me testify today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks. Questions for John?
Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate you being here. Ready, Linda? Linda, just before you start, while I've got this kind of at the forefront of my mind, before I forget, Ben, I'd like to start maybe tomorrow with just a real quick overview, if we can bring some copies of the sentencing guideline paperwork, so at least we can give the committee an understanding a little bit before we dive into the institution, so we can kind of make some distinctions between what 1145 really means, the types of offenses where people would fall in the sentencing guideline, so we can maybe walk through that a little bit. We may want to ask Phil or one of those guys to come help, or you guys can help walk us through that. I'd just like to take a real brief time to do that, so it affects corrections much more so than any other budget that we've had. We had kind of some kind of offhanded discussions. We don't have to go into it in any detail, but at least people will understand, and I can help in how to read the quick. Yeah, the chart, the front and the back, and you could do a color copy on these if we need to. Yeah. Linda.
Mr. Chair, member of the subcommittee, for the record, Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services Budget Management. I believe you have the handout before you for the 2003-05 Department of Corrections Governor's Budget. On page 2, a couple of points. One is that this budget is 10.9% greater in general fund than the closed session budget for 0103. It's 20% greater than the budget as it stood through the fifth special session. Again, that's in general fund. Second, on total funds, it's down 1.4% from closed session, 19.6% from fifth special session. This percentage change includes other funds non-limited, which is kind of a one-time big bump in 0103 that pretty much distorts percentage comparisons. So I'll be talking about that in a different way as we go on. On page 2, we see the budget by fund type, and I believe you've already seen that, obviously, with 95.6% at general fund. That's lion's share. Federal funds are the state criminal alien assistance program funds that are sent by the feds, federal government to the state for partially supporting the alien incarceration. Other funds come from a variety of sources, for instance, inmate work crews, inmate services, product sales, donations, inmate welfare fund, which is money from telephone calls, canteen profits, and so forth. The next two pages talk about the major changes to the I-103 budget. And here I'm saying that the governor's budget is a 0.7% increase from the O103 legislatively approved budget, and again that excludes the other funds non-limited portion of the O103 budget. The major changes beginning total $66 million overall in general fund reduction, but in total funds because of fund shifting, a $20 million total funds reduction. In February, there was a $16 million rebalance that took care of some medical care costs, overtime differentials, and fuel costs, and reduced, it was first of several reductions to debt service. It also reduced the food purchase costs, as we've discussed earlier, consolidated health care, and delayed and used delayed hiring for cost reductions. Second special session took a $37 million reduction, including some more debt service reduction, in this case $23 million. The other reductions were in administration, central support, institutions and programs, and then there was an inflation reduction, not of total inflation, but of $1 million of the community corrections inflation at that time. The next page goes on to Special Session 3 and Special Session 5. Special Session 3 had a $10 million increase in general fund as a result of funding the compensation package costs at about 75% of what agencies were requiring to fund it. Correctional programs were reduced by $2 million at that time. And in Special Session 5, there was another debt service reduction, this time $11 million, and then reductions in institutions and programs and in community corrections. The inflation was reduced. And through Special Session 5, the cumulative debt service reductions were $49 million. Post-Special Session 5, there was a November rebalance, which reduced debt service yet another $3 million. And then Senate Bill 5548 had another small debt service reduction and a reduction in capital improvements and also in administration and central support. Cumulative through the Senate Bill 5548 reductions was a $71 million total over the biennium. The next page, page 6, takes a different look at the budget, and that is what's in rather than what's out. Major programs and services included in the governor's budget include incarceration for 12,002 to 12,786 inmates July 103 through June 3005. That is the October 2002 forecast. The governor's balanced budget is not updated for April. And there's $125 million in general fund for medical, alcohol, and drug education and religious programs in the program section. Community corrections funding is at $153 million in general fund. And finally, debt service is $107.5 million, about 11% of the budget. The next two pages provide graphical displays by program unit and budget categories. On page 7 is a display that you have already seen in the LFO introductory materials. Doug's was stacked bar, this is pot, but it shows the same thing. Programs and institutions, again, in this case, over 63% of the budget. Central support and operations added to administration is less than 10% of the budget and less than the percentage of debt service is to the whole budget. Community corrections, 16% of the budget. And I would also point out that you will not see any capital construction here. Within budget categories on page 8, personal services would be the largest component because a lot of security staff is required. Second largest services and supplies at 18%. Special payments would be the payments to providers for a lot of program services. Debt service, 11%. And finally, capital outlay is 1%. The next six pages complete the process of building the 0305 budget, starting on page 9, the legislatively adopted budget. At close of session was just about $1 billion, total funds, $862 million general fund. Legislatively approved actions through April 2002 included the rebalance we've already alluded to in February of 2002, which had a $16 million fund shift to accommodate debt service reduction. Senate Bill 5575 was the second special session, and that was a total of $37 million in reductions, a combination of one-time and permanent reductions. Base budget adjustments had $85 million roll-up for the 0103 position actions. As Doug pointed out earlier, this does include in salary increases that were not taken out of this budget prior to the governor submitting it. Debt service increase, $61 million general fund, and there was also a reduction of $249 million other funds non-limited debt service and an accompanying $2 million of non-limited other funds reduction. And this was a one-time action to accommodate refinancing or refunding all of the COPs outstanding in order to take advantage of better interest rates. And this was done during the 0103 biennium. So it's an limitation that's required one time only, and then it's washed out. Capital construction reduction was $95 million total funds, of which $2 million was general fund. On page 10, we start with the essential packages. Package 010 is non-PICS personal services. There was one exceptional inflation increase for negotiated labor agreements, and then just normal mass transit tax increases and vacancy factor calculations. Those were not exceptional. Package 020 handles one-time costs, phase-ins and phase-outs, and in this case there was a phase-in of the full 24-month costs of programs and facilities that were opened during the 0103 biennium, such as at Coffee Creek and Two Rivers. One-time costs were eliminated that were associated, again, with starting those new programs. Coffee Creek Correctional Facility is another example of this. And finally, there were one-time reductions made in the February 8th second special session that are restored in this package. On the next page, we have inflation and mandated caseload. Inflation totaled $24 million in general fund. It included an exceptional medical service provider inflation of $4 million. And this is the outside medical service provider. Stake up and service charges increased $7 million. Professional services were inflated at 3.9%, and community corrections and ordinary inflation was included at 3.5%. Mandated caseload took us from the April 2002 prison population forecast, or was taken from the April 2002 forecast. It was $66 million in institutions and programs for a larger forecast. And there was an addition of $13 million in administration and central support also related to that forecast. There was a reduction of $6 million in community corrections because that forecast count was reduced from the prior 0103 count. On the next page, page 12, we start with we have fund shifts and technical adjustments. And the fund shift is simply a decrease in general fund and increase in federal funds related to state criminal alien assistance program funds. They had been used at Clackamas County at the intake center. However, with the opening of the Coffee Creek intake center, they weren't needed and have been redirected to other previously general fund uses. The technical adjustments implement budget notes that had appeared in House Bill 5008 in 2001. One had to do with centralizing telecommunications and information systems, and the other had to do with decentralizing attorney general budgets, taking them to individual divisions. Finally, there was oversight of release counselors moved from administration to institutions. These changes were also in the agency's November 2002 rebalance, so they were covered for the 0103 binding at that time. On page 13, we begin the policy packages. Package 081 covered biennializing changes that were made in the third special session. It was $3.8 million general fund reduction It included salary range 38 and above, cost of living eliminations, about $100,000. There were 13 positions that were eliminated in the third special session. However, the funding for those positions was moved to services and supplies to cover professional services. And finally, correctional programs reductions were biannualized at $3.7 million. And specifically, these were work-based programs, cognitive restructuring, and transitional services programs that were changed in the June special session. Moving to Package 084 in the November 2002 Emergency Board, this was simply moving one position from institutions to administration. Very simple. The 090 program reduction package that follows was $20 million in general funds, $0.3 million in other funds. And this found savings in health care provision as a result of some changes in delivery of health care within the institution that the agency had made. It also brought the October 2002 forecast into this budget, but while that was an increase for the prison population, it was offset by construction delays. And finally, there were 145 positions that were eliminated in this package. On the following page, we start with package 091. This was biennializing changes that were made or reductions that were taken in the fifth special session. It was $192 million in general fund, and the reductions in House Bill 5100 from the fifth special session did assume statutory changes in order to release inmates and to close institutions and eliminate positions. So that is what the 091 package shows. However, this was partially reversed in the next package, in the 092, which is usually called an additional program reductions package. In this case, it's program reductions and restoration. It adds a net of $103 million general fund back to the budget. There's $118 million to reverse the inmate release plan and use instead additional temporary and emergency beds. It does not increase construction, but it still manages the population. It also took away $15 million in general fund inflation on agency services and supplies and also on provider payments. Package 186, the new certificates of participation. This was added in order to accommodate debt service for two projects. One was the Multnomah County Senate Bill 1145 commitment. There was $2.1 million in debt service there. And then Department of Corrections Operations funding, they had prepaid for certain construction activities at Lakeview using operations funding and wanted the prepay refunded. Not listed here, but also in the governor's budget, Package 124, this is $1.2 million in federal funds expenditure limitation. The emergency board was approached during 0103 for approval to request a violent offender transition program grant from the federal government. The agency received that grant in 0103. It's a three-year grant. This is the 0305 portion of that grant, continuing the unspent portion. Package 132 is a security review differential funding package. It's the other funds portion of an agency request for general fund to fund non-security positions when they work in security type, when they come into contact with inmates in the routine course of their jobs. This package happens to be about $40,000 of other funds expenditure limitation.
And where is 132 listed there?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, 132 is not listed, nor is package 124. I can bring you more details.
Let's come off the end of the page, and I was looking for it.
My apologies for that. It was a late discovery in the preparation of the presentation document.
Thank you.
The last page, page 16, shows potential unfunded liabilities. There are things that were not in the governor's balanced budget that we discovered as we moved along through the process. So the first two, if we're looking at the table, the first one is the State Criminal Alien Assistance Program funding reduction. It's expected in 0305 that there will be less of that funding from the federal government than we've had in the previous two federal fiscal years. That adjustment then would need general fund backfill in the amount of about $5 million. This is in the governor's revised budget, but I haven't prepared a new display that would reflect the differences between governor's balance and governor's revised. I would expect that that would come further on down the process. The second item is debt service. The debt service of $7.5 million that we added to governor's balanced budget, as Doug revealed earlier, we need only about $1.5 million of that. The rest of it can be reduced. So we have something of a wash between these first two items. And that reduction in debt service is also included in the governor's revised budget. In the governor's revised budget, as a line item with no funding attached to it, is the construction of the Lakeview facility. We've had discussion of this earlier today. The reason there are no dollars attached to it in 0305 is that the funding can be arranged for in the September or the fall 2003 COP sale, and the first biennium's interest can be covered by that funding with no actual principal payment in 0305. That would, however, lead to debt service in 0507 and beyond, and the roll-up on that is not for certain for debt service plus operations, but it could run around $35 million, including all of that funding in 0507. However, it is in the governor's revised budget, and it is at zero because in 0305 it can be done that way. Construction staff, the fourth item in the table, inadvertently we left other fund expenditure limitation in some positions in the governor's budget for construction staff that did not need to be there because all the other construction activity had been shut down. I should point out that this number is net of three positions that we would want to retain for the Lakeview construction project. Finally, as a result of the April 2003 forecast, the inmate population goes up and would require $6.55 million in general fund to manage it. The April forecast, the community corrections forecast, is another reduction from the October 2002 forecast. And I am showing we'll continue to have discussions about just what size is this shortfall. The shortfall I'm showing here is the difference between the $153 million that is in the governor's balanced budget and the $183 million that is now the calculated need from community corrections. So that's how I got to the $30 million of this particular budget hole. This item and the April forecast, the last four items in the table, are not included in the governor's revised budget. So we need to do a little bit more work on that, working together with the agency and the fiscal staff. And that completes my presentation.
Thank you, Linda. We're a little bit over. I do want to look at some of these holes. The committee's aware of these holes. We've briefly discussed them. I know you're talking with, I know DAS is talking with the department as well as Doug, as well as the local affected parties as to really what that looks like. So we're going to get those. The only other thing that I want to make sure when we talk about community corrections at some point in time or maybe on Tuesday is that we have a discussion surrounding what it looks like if the local jurisdictions opt out and what those costs would be to the state and how we would measure those. We obviously don't have enough beds within the state system to come close to handling what that would look like, so what we would do in terms of rental and all the other various components that we would have to put in place. And really I don't know how we deal with the timeline, but anyway, that's an issue. So I either want to make sure that we deal with that when we're dealing specifically with 1145 and the holes in community corrections, or if we want to maybe rotate the schedule around to do that closer to the end to give you all and Doug and Van and the department enough time. But I will let the staff people who are doing those things. But I think we should have a discussion on one, what the whole looks like and what the various components are that are embedded or not embedded in the whole, and two, what the opt-out looks like. Ben, why don't you come up so Christine can get down the record?
Mr. Chair, Ben DeHaan from the Department of Corrections. I just wanted to let you know that we're ready to go with that discussion anytime it works into your schedule. We've got the work done.
Well, why don't you coordinate through Doug, and we'll figure out when's the logical time in terms of your presentation, or if we have to rejuggle part of the presentation.
Okay.
That would be helpful, but tomorrow we'll start off with the sets and guidelines for a few minutes, just so people understand where we're at, who provides what programs. All right. Thank you. With that, we're going to carry out House Bill 5509 until tomorrow, which is Tuesday, April 22nd. And at that, we're adjourned.